May I please the court, Robert Cortez, registration number 19577, appearing on behalf of the appellate defendant, Demetrius White. Mr. White is appealing from the judgment of conviction entered on two verdicts, finding him guilty of knowing or reckless child abuse resulting in serious bodily injury and negligent child abuse resulting in death. And although we briefed five issues in our opening and reply brief, I want to focus my time this afternoon on three of those issues. We're not abandoning in any way, shape, or form the other two issues. I just think we've adequately addressed them in the briefing, and unless the panel has any questions, I just rely on what we put in the brief. By way of background, the conviction on the charge of negligent child abuse resulting in death was based on the jury finding that the defendant was responsible for causing his infant son to suffer from a fractured skull, cerebral edema, subdural hematoma, and retinal hemorrhaging. And let me also preface the rest of my argument by saying that there's no dispute that the injuries which the child suffered from were horrific. The only issue at trial really focused on whether Mr. White was responsible for causing those injuries or not. The conviction on the charge of serious bodily injury, child abuse, was based on the jury concluding that my client was responsible for multiple rib fractures that the child had sustained. And because the rib fractures were apparently sustained at a time other than the head injuries, the sentences that were imposed on the two counts were run consecutively, not concurrently, so that my client received a 21-year sentence on the serious bodily injury count and a 10-year sentence on the child abuse resulting in death count. The victim, as the panel is probably aware from reviewing the briefs, was the 3-month-old son of the defendant and his girlfriend, Michelle Wayne. And the child was born in June of 2003. And during the first couple of months of the child's life, the child's mother was involved in the raising of the child. And at the end of August, I think it was the last week in August 2003, mom went back to work full time. And my client became the primary caregiver. Despite the fact that my client was the child's primary caregiver, he was not the exclusive caregiver. There were various family members who, at time to time, babysat for the child. On October 2nd, my client and Ms. Wayne brought the baby to Children's Hospital. The baby presented in distress, acute distress, was having trouble breathing. And initially was seen by Dr. Mark Roback, who was the emergency room physician at Children's Hospital. He brought Dr. Sorotnik in as a consult, and they quickly diagnosed that the child had bilateral skull fractures, subdural hemorrhaging, and the multiple rib fractures. The child lapsed into a vegetative state, and on October 15th, I believe, life support was discontinued, and the child passed away. The issues that I wanted to talk about, first of all, involved the jury instructions that were given on the mens rea elements of the two charges in this case. And the instruction I'm referring to is in volume 2 of the record, page 304. And in it, there are four paragraphs. And the first three paragraphs that I'm talking about, Judge Wheeler gave correct definitions of the terms knowingly, recklessly, and criminally negligent. Those were correctly defined. But then he goes on, and I think it was the last paragraph in that instruction. He adds the language, quote, "the culpable mental state refers to the defendant's general awareness or lack thereof of the circumstances endangering a child, not to his specific awareness that his conduct would cause some specific result," end of quote. That's a correct statement in the context of a knowing or reckless child abuse case. And it's taken from the language in People v. Noble and People v. Thompson, which only involved the knowing or reckless child abuse, form of child abuse. In this case, we have different charges against my client.
Mr. Borges, didn't Judge Wheeler add the phrase "or lack thereof" to deal with the negligence issue?
He did. It's parenthetical in the instruction. And it's our position that that was not adequate. Because it's mixed in with the other language, it did not, it's our position that that did not clarify it adequately.
And with regard to that same instruction, are you saying that the lack of awareness is used in the jury instruction means something different than a failure to perceive?
Yes.
And what is that difference?
All right.
Or what do you claim that difference is?
The knowing and reckless theory of culpability is based upon awareness. Aware that circumstances exist. Aware that a result will occur. When we get in the context of the criminal negligence theory of culpability, there's no awareness. It's a failure to perceive, and it's our position that they're conceptually so different that this jury instruction was misleading and therefore erroneous. There should have been a different way of presenting it.
And how do you propose that the jury should have been instructed instead?
Well, initially, Judge Wheeler did catch on to what the problem was here, and it's in the record, page 2869 and 2870, where he recognizes the difference between the awareness mens rea and the failure to perceive mens rea. What I would propose, and I wasn't trial counsel, but break these up into separate instructions. In other words, do a separate instruction on the knowing reckless theory, and then a separate instruction on the criminal negligent theory. And you can include that language from Noble and Thompson in the knowing and reckless instruction, mens rea instruction, and not have it in the other. That's just how I would have proposed it.
Let's assume you're right on the instruction argument. How does it affect your client who's saying, I didn't do any of this?
That's a fair question, Judge Rothenberg, and the people raise that in their answer brief, and my reply to that would be, just because the defendant focused on one theory of defense at trial doesn't mean he wasn't entitled to have the jury properly instructed on all elements of the offense. I think there's still an independent obligation that the trial judge had to instruct properly on the mens rea elements. So I don't know if that answers the question. If there are no other questions on that issue, I was going to try to move on to the next one. All right. The second issue I wanted to address involves the testimony about the bite mark that was introduced at trial. And trial counsel objected to that. There was an adequate record made as to the basis for our objection. But the people in their brief cite Rule 401 of the Rules of Evidence, which is, you know, states that there's a very broad standard for admissibility of evidence at trial, and that's a correct statement. But 401 is followed by 403 and 404, and the other rules temper what is allowed to be admitted. In this case, this was extremely prejudicial testimony, and whatever probative value it had was negligible. I understand Dr. Sorotnik made reference to it as being part of the constellation of injuries. I think that was the term that was used at trial. Constellation of injuries that led him to conclude that this was non-accidental trauma that this child died from. It's our position that whatever probative value, the bite mark had was so minimal compared to the other evidence that Dr. Sorotnik had to rely on to come up with his conclusion. And I'm talking about the bilateral skull fractures, the subdural hematoma, and the broken ribs. That's a lot more relevant to what the prosecution's theory was as to what happened to this child. And, you know, perhaps the most troubling thing about the bite mark is everybody seemed to agree that there was no way of connecting my client to the bite mark. There was nothing to indicate that my client was the source of those teeth marks. So it's our position it was highly prejudicial, and it had such minimal value that the prejudicial effect of it outweighed any probative value it had, and it was an abuse of discretion to allow it in.
Mr. Borkus, but, you know, just like you've admitted, there were other injuries that were much more relevant, but there were also other injuries that were much more serious and much more is compelling to the jury. So why would the bite mark have affected the jury verdict when, you know, they could easily have focused on the hemorrhaging, on the rib fractures, on, you know, the other things that were really more permanent and internal injuries as opposed to, you know, something on the skin?
And Judge Schloss, it's our position that this evidence served to portray the defendant as just a bad character. I appreciate what Your Honor is saying, that given the nature, the severity of the other injuries, that this was probably harmless. And we would beg to differ. There was just such a piling on of bad acts evidence in this case. There was the dunking incident, there was the bite mark, and of course there was the serious injuries, that, you know, this could only have served to push it even further. And the last issue, just unless there were any other questions about that issue, I just had two quick points to make about the last issue I want to talk about, was the sufficiency of the evidence. And just two quick points on that one. The people state in their brief multiple times that there was overwhelming evidence of guilt in this case. That's incorrect. There was overwhelming evidence that the child died from a fractured skull and subdural bleeding. And I think there were no less than four doctors that testified to that, and that's not really in dispute. What there was not overwhelming evidence that my client caused these injuries. That was in dispute at trial. My client admittedly was the primary caregiver for this child, but he did not have exclusive caregiving responsibilities for the child. The other thing I wanted to say regarding the sufficiency of the evidence is, at trial, the prosecution's case relied in large part on debunking the catapulting, that's what I call it, the catapulting episode. The report that my client said that the child flew off the bed when he jumped on the bed. And a lot of the evidence focused on that. It's our position that, with all due respect to the people's argument there, that it would have been improper for the jury to infer the affirmative from the lack of a negative. In other words, just because the people debunked that theory didn't mean that the jury could conclude that my client caused these injuries. So unless there are any other questions, I'd like to reserve my 2 minutes and 32 seconds.
Okay, very well, Mr. Burkett.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Catherine Idalo, registration number 39218, representing the people in this matter. I'll start with the instructional issue. The instruction that the mens reas for child abuse didn't apply to the degree of injury was a correct statement of the law. And I think the defendant on this issue is overlooking the language in the additional instruction, and this was in parentheses, or lack thereof, which the people believe was sufficient to convey to the jury that applied to criminal negligence when combined with the definition for criminal negligence, which the defendant concedes was accurately instructed.
Ms. Idalo, Mr. Borges did discuss that instruction, the language or lack thereof, but he suggested that the more appropriate course of action would have been to have had two separate instructions. What is your thought about that?
You know, I don't think the issue here is whether there could have been something done that would have been a little bit more clear. I think this instruction was adequate as is, and I honestly disagree that it was confusing in that respect. When you look at, this was all given as one instruction. There was the definition of knowingly, recklessly, criminal negligence, and then this other instruction. And I don't think that was confusing for the jury to put together when they read the instructions as a whole. And just a quick point on harmlessness on this issue. I really haven't heard any articulation of prejudice from the defendant on this issue. His theories of defense were that other people could have harmed the baby or that the baby accidentally fell off the bed. Neither of these had anything to do with this instructional issue. And I cited case law in my brief to support this proposition. It almost sounds to me like the defendant's argument is almost a structural error issue on this point, but I think it's certainly a valid point that there was no prejudice to the defendant based on his theory of defense. I'll move on to the next issue that the defendant presented here at argument, the evidence about the bite mark. I think evidence that the doctor observed what appeared to be a bite mark on the baby's leg was relevant because it informed their conclusions that his injuries were not an accident. They were the result of abuse. I think the defendant's misunderstanding Rule 401 takes, and he contends the bite mark was irrelevant because the prosecution couldn't prove that he inflicted it, or alternatively, that it was not relevant because the prosecution had other evidence that the baby's injuries were the result of abuse. Frankly, I think that argument really undercuts his sufficiency of the evidence argument, because I do believe there was overwhelming evidence that these injuries were the result of abuse and the defendant inflicted them. But the prosecution is certainly entitled to prove their case and to explain the basis of the expert's conclusions that these injuries were not an accident. And then just to touch on something that Judge Fox raised with the defendant in his argument, I think when you consider that the defendant was accused of breaking his son's skull in multiple places, fracturing 10 of his ribs, causing his retinas to hemorrhage, I think evidence that there may have been a bite mark was really quite minimal when you consider the things that he was accused of. I think there's case law to support that proposition as far as the prejudice. And again, I won't go through it at this point. I think it's pretty adequately stated in my brief, but I think this evidence was harmless when you consider the overwhelming evidence of the defendant's guilt. And lastly, I'll touch on the sufficiency of the evidence argument. The reason that I argued in my brief that there was overwhelming evidence that the baby's injuries and death were the result of abuse and not an accident, because at trial and in his briefs, the defendant contended that the child accidentally fell off the bed. That was one of his alternative theories. So that's the reason that I went through the very strong evidence here that these injuries were the result of abuse.
Ms. Idala, what's your response to Mr. Borquez's argument that apart from the catapulting episode, as he referred to it, that there was not clear evidence as to who had caused the injuries to the child?
I think a plain reading of the record will show that is not true. The defendant, I'll go through the evidence that the defendant's girlfriend was the primary caregiver of the child for the first 2 months of his life while the defendant was working. Baby was perfectly fine and healthy and had a well-baby visit either the day of or the day before the defendant's girlfriend went back to work. And the next month, which was the final month of the baby's life, the defendant was the primary caregiver. And I believe the evidence was that maybe a couple of occasions someone else watched the child, but the defendant was the primary caregiver. And every time the baby incurred a suspicious injury, which the defendant gave a frankly incredible explanation for, happened under the defendant's watch. There was the incident where the baby had a black eye. That was the first day. The defendant's girlfriend came home from work, baby had a black eye, said the baby fell and hit his face on a car seat. And then there was 3 days before the baby lost consciousness forever, there was the incident where defendant's girlfriend came home, baby had a pocket of fluid on his head and it was squishy. And the defendant said, the baby fell on the counter that time. And then, of course, October 2nd of 2003 was when the baby stopped breathing and eventually went to the hospital and it never regained consciousness. And that was when the defendant gave the explanation of the baby falling off the bed, which was not what he originally said, but, you know, the story changed there. And
there was also another incident where he put his fist through a wall.
Yes, he did that, and then he also, there was something with breaking a closet door, and there was evidence that the defendant was frequently became angry with the baby because the baby wouldn't stop crying. So, you know, there's all of this evidence, and then we also have, you know, the defendant was, he told police that he was the primary caregiver of the baby. So I think it's really to tie this back into the standards for the sufficiency of the evidence, that people are not required to prove that, to disprove that someone else may have injured this baby. Our burden is to show there was substantial and sufficient evidence to support the defendant's guilt, and I think that standard is met in spades in this case. if the court has any further questions, people would ask you to affirm.
Thank you, Ms. Idala.
Very quickly, Your Honors. I believe the incident about the cracked bedroom closet door was the incident. There was only one incident. He didn't put his fist through a wall and the bedroom closet.
Just door. One.
Just one.
Okay.
And regarding my client having an anger issue, that I believe did come out of trial, but also Ms. Wayne testified that at no time did she ever see him do anything, vent that anger on the child. The only other thing I wanted to add in reply to the people's argument, Your Honors, is in our brief, and I'm not going to go through the whole thing in 1 minute, 45 seconds, but starting on page 7 of the opening brief, I start to go through a chronology of events beginning the end of September, and there were various days the child spent with other family members, and that's on pages 8 and 9 of the brief, that he spent time with his maternal grandmother, Shelley Wayne, that he spent time with his maternal grand aunt, Linda Henke, and her husband. And there were certain dates that I think are highly relevant. It was around September 29th that Wayne noticed a bump or soft spot on the child's head that appeared to feel like a pocket of fluid. Around this time, the baby was in my client's care, but he was also in the care of other people as well. And the doctors at Children's Hospital couldn't determine the precise time when the child was injured, but they could backdate it, or they could determine it was about 3 or 4 days prior to when the child presented. So it was around the 28th or 29th of September. So if you look at our opening brief, we do go over what other family members the baby was with in addition to the defendant. If there are no other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Borges, and thank you, Ms. Idala. Thank you again, both, for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.